Good evening.
Oh, thank you.
You're all very welcome to tonight's event at the Forum. My name's Beth Hannon and I'm the Associate Director of the Forum. If you don't know us, the Forum's a non-profit educational organisation. We're devoted to putting on philosophy events, getting philosophers and other academics out into a public forum to discuss their work with one another and with the public. We rely on the generosity of our donors and the support of the LSE, for which we are incredibly grateful. If you think that these kinds of events are important and valuable, please consider donating to us via our webpage. You'll find our Just Giving link there. If you go to our website, you'll also find podcasts of our previous events. There's an awful lot of them. They go back many years, as well as essays from contemporary philosophers and other thinkers for you to enjoy. This event is being recorded for a podcast, so if you have your phone on, could you please turn off the volume so that it isn't recorded on the podcast, nor does it disturb our speakers. You can keep your phone on, just turn off the volume. You're welcome to tweet along with tonight's event. We have a hashtag, LSEFEP. And if you do ask a question, please wait for the roving mic to find you so your voice is picked up for the podcast. That's it from me. I'll hand you over to our chair for tonight's event, Danielle Sands.
Hello, good evening. I'm Danielle Sands. I'm a fellow at the Forum for European Philosophy, and I'm going to be chairing this evening's event, in which our three speakers will be addressing the topic work, the digital economy, and the labouring body. So each of the speakers will have about 10 minutes to respond informally to the topic, and then there'll be lots of time for discussion between the panel and then questions from the audience. So let me introduce our speakers. So first up will be Dr. Jamie Woodcock, who is a fellow at in the Department of Management here at the LSE. Second will be Dr. Nick Cernick, who is a lecturer in international political economy at City, the University of London. And our final speaker will be Dr. Helen Hester, who is senior lecturer in media and communication at the London School of Film, Media and Design. Okay, I'm going to hand over to our first speaker, Dr. Jamie Woodcock.
So thank you very much for the introduction and the invitation to speak today. What I'm going to be talking about is digital labour today. So I want to talk about the changes of computerisation and the transformation of work in the contemporary economy. The previous research projects that are feeding into this conversation, into this discussion, are the first is I've been doing research in call centres. So I did my PhD project. It was an undercover ethnography, a covert ethnography of a call centre, looking at management practices, the use of technology, and how people resist and organise in call centres. So taking a perhaps particularly bad example of new kinds of work, call centres, especially high sales call centres, are places that people don't necessarily enjoy working in, and also many of you probably don't enjoy receiving calls from people working in call centres, to try and think about how work is changing. But before I get on to talk about that, what I want to start with is just to kind of introduce my perspective on the issue and hopefully show you where I'm coming from in this talk. So I'm in a management department, but I have a sociology of work background. So what I'm really interested in is why we work, why we choose to go and spend most of our time doing this activity, how we work, and what happens while we're at work. And so for me, when we try and understand these broad changes, what's happening in the world of work, what's happening with technology, I think a really important starting point is to look at labour and the labour process, what it is that people are actually doing, how they're doing it, the ways they're being managed, and to understand these things through the experiences of people who are making things or doing things or providing services. So if we think about it, labour in its simplest terms is just how people interact with the environment around them. It could be from the very simplest acts of gathering food or making shelter to the much more complicated acts of designing computer algorithms or these kind of more technologically advanced things. And as we kind of see the development of human society, we see increasingly complicated relationships of labour emerge. The things that we do on a day-to-day basis start to have increasingly less to do with how we meet our basic needs. So working in a call centre, for example, doesn't have a direct relationship with how you feed, clothe, provide shelter, or meet other basic needs. And somehow, in the example of the call centre that I studied, selling life insurance, not a very good life insurance product, selling this was how I met my basic needs from that job. And these things have become even more complicated because we have a global division of labour in which jobs become distributed across the whole world, and we get increasingly more complicated relationships that emerge. And the one that I want to look at in particular is what happens when things are computerized or digitalized, and think through exactly what processes are taking place here. And to do this, I think we need to talk a little bit about what we mean by software when we talk about software. As often when we think about digital labor, it's easy to think about the kind of glossy marketing of how these things are going to change our lives, how ordering a taxi through Uber is going to be an effortless process, or you don't have to cook dinner tonight because a Deliveroo person is going to deliver your food for you. Instead, I want to drill down a little bit into exactly what's happening with this kind of technology. And to do this, I think it's important to return to the legacy of Marx's work on technology. To think about technology as a tool that is produced by people within certain conditions and then used by people within sets of conditions. So in order to do this, we can see that technology is introduced in workplaces for particular reasons, often to do with efficiency. So in call centres, computers were introduced in order to speed up the process of dialing calls. Before the modern call centre, there were handsets with people with reams of paper and numbers calling them, ticking them off if they'd made a sale, and so on. The integration of the computer allows a huge speed up in the quantity of calls that are made. In many call centres, this also allows huge amounts of information to be collected. How long did you take to finish the call? How long did you wait between calls? And in the call centre I worked in, you were allowed 5 seconds between the end of a call and the start of the next one. Also allows the timing of breaks down to the second. You know, did you spend more time than you should have done? All of these things can be logged and controlled. When we start to think about technology in this way, we can see that its implementation isn't neutral. In the call centre, the manager of the call centre, the owner of the call centre, wants an increase in the number of sales. They want a high volume of sales. It's profitable for the call centre. But this creates an experience in the call centre that's not a nice experience for people who are working in there. In a typical shift in the call centre I worked in, you could be calling 400 people in an afternoon. You could have a very difficult experience, for example, finding out that somebody was, you know, unwell and couldn't take out the life insurance and so on, or, you know, various things that had happened in people's lives. You have to move straight on to the next phone call. Of course, there's also the angry conversations that I'm sure some of us are familiar with in the crowd when we talk to call centres. Now, Marx develops this to talk about how tools are implemented. So we can think of the telephone as a tool. We can think of various things that we use in our day-to-day life as tools. But importantly, also talks about the shift from a tool to a machine. And the implementation of machines, that is, tools that are able to carry out a task that was previously done before, is having a huge effect on the world of work. So for many call centres, these are becoming automated. Increasingly now, when you call into a company, you dial through, you know, press one for some action or so on. And lots of these elements are becoming taken away from control from workers themselves and into automated systems. It's difficult to automate the sales process itself. How you convince somebody to part with their money for life insurance or whatever other product you're selling in the call centre is a difficult thing to do. And one of the things that I've written about is the pressure of emotional labour. The way in which at work now we're increasingly tasked with using our emotions, mobilising feeling to in a sales encounter or a service encounter, which means when we're managed, it's no longer enough that we just turn up to work and that we're there. In a call centre, that's not good enough. You can't just go through the motions. Instead, what's required is a complicated package of emotions, dealing with angry customers, putting them at ease, making them feel like they want to buy insurance. These things are difficult to automate at present, because what it requires is that social interaction that convinces us to put our hand in our pocket and part with money. But increasingly, we can see more and more areas where automation is becoming common. And what I want to talk about in the last couple of minutes is the next project that I'm working on, which is with a company called Deliveroo, which I don't know if people are familiar with. So this is one of those Uber 4X companies, in this case being food delivery, which has taken a task that is something we could all recognize, the delivery of food. You know, we could think about it as the outsourcing of our domestic labor for the evening, having somebody else cook us our food and have it delivered. But in the kind of novelty here is organizing it across a digital platform. So Deliveroo pitches itself as being able to connect self-employed drivers with restaurants and with customers, bringing these things together in a kind of seamless or technological platform. Now, what I think is interesting to look at in an example like Deliveroo is we take the technology too often for granted. We can look at the delivery drivers and what's happening there. We could perhaps look at the owners and how much funding they're getting for the business. But we don't talk enough about the labor that goes into the construction of the software that these platforms run on. And I want to introduce a distinction, a three-way distinction, that I think is important for understanding this. We have what we could call labor on the digital, so the kind of labor that produces software. So why does the Deliveroo software track delivery drivers at every point? Why does it tell them that they have a certain amount of time to deliver? You know, why is this tracking so embedded into the platform? We then have what we could call labor with the digital, so labor that's being transformed through the application of digital technology. You know, we could see this in perhaps call centers. People made phone calls before computerization. But with the introduction of these technologies, office work, this kind of work is being transformed by technology. But we can also say that there's a third kind, a kind of a labor for the digital, the creation of new kinds of jobs. So this kind of delivery work that's been transformed into working solely on an app, and other kinds of forms of work like crowdsourcing and manipulation of digital technology. And the question that I want to finish with, and perhaps we can discuss this a little bit further later on, is when we look at a company like Deliveroo, they claim to employ no drivers, they own no restaurants, they have an entirely kind of outsourced, self-employed, and arguably they're not self-employed, the drivers, they're employees. Why do we need Deliveroo? You know, why does somebody have to own that platform? And I think the same is very true with Uber and some of these other examples. And what we need to ask is, how was that technology designed? You know, why does it put the pressure to rate each other, to meet certain performance targets? And think perhaps that the onset of digital technology has opened up much broader possibilities about how we change the world that could be taken up rather than using these things to rate each other with 5 stars and encourage delivery drivers to cycle all across London at below minimum wage. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Nick Senek is our next speaker.
I want to answer this basic question today. Will robots take your job? We see fears of it everywhere. If you go anywhere across the media today, you've probably seen some sort of major headline saying, robots are going to take your job, and we have to worry about this as an issue. Some of the most famous stats, there was one study done from Oxford, says that 47% of current U.S. jobs could be automated within the next 2 decades. Now, this is could be automated, not necessarily will be automated, but this is the outer reaches of possibility. Now, a similar study was done for the Eurozone, and it suggested that 54% of the Eurozone's jobs could be automated. The Bank of England in the UK did its own study, and it says that 15 million jobs, or about half of the labor force, could be automated here in the UK. So these are the sort of top-line headline figures that we're constantly seeing, warning us of the threat of robots taking jobs. Now, this is a global problem as well, and I think we often forget this. This isn't just a rich country problem. So this is a figure from a World Bank report looking at how many jobs are automatable across the world. And what you'll notice is actually low-income developing economies are going to be hit harder by automation than the rich countries. So we have Nigeria at 65%, we have China at 77%, and the highest that I've seen, Ethiopia, a full 85% of jobs could be automated there. Now, this makes sense because what has been outsourced to these economies is oftentimes low-wage, low-skill, repetitive jobs that are very easy for machines to do. But so this is the global sort of problem. Robots seem to be on the verge of taking all of our jobs. Now, I want to ask the question, is this actually going to be the case? And I think we have to, our answer is going to be dependent upon two different scenarios. Either there's going to be strong labor power, so strong trade unions, strong workers' movements, strong workers' rights, or there's going to be a situation where trade unions aren't very strong and where they struggle to fight against companies. So I want to look at each of these scenarios in turn and sort of suggest what is the outcome going to be. Now, in the first scenario, we have strong labor. So plenty of trade unions, workers' rights, a strong workers' movement. What happens in that circumstance? Well, we get high wage growth. So workers are constantly pushing for higher and higher wages. Wages go up. What does this mean for businesses, though? It means suddenly workers are more expensive, machines are relatively cheaper. So there's more and more incentive to invest in automation as a result of higher and higher wages. So what happens in that circumstance? We should expect businesses to be investing a lot into robots, investing a lot into automation, and we should expect to see higher productivity figures. So productivity is just a measure of how efficient we are producing things. And we would think that as there's more and more automation, there's going to be higher and higher productivity. So this is the strong labor power scenario. Higher wages lead to more automation. The best example of this today happens to be China. We look at China, and we tend to think of China still being a cheap labor economy. That's less and less the case. So over the past 10 years or so, Chinese wages have risen up quite rapidly, and you can sort of see that in this chart here of Chinese wages. Now, what would we expect? We'd expect to be there to be a lot of investment in automation. This chart here shows how much investment is going into industrial robots in various countries. The red line that's spiking up there, that's China's projected growth in industrial robots. So as Chinese wages go up, Chinese factories are purchasing tons and tons of robots. The most famous example of this is probably Foxconn, makers of things like Sony PlayStation and the iPhone. They want to automate all of their factories. They want to replace 1 million workers with 1 million robots. And this is exactly what is happening in the Chinese economy right now. So this is what happens with a strong labor power. We end up getting a lot of automation. But now automation doesn't hit every job sector equally. There's going to be losers and there's going to be winners. I think the losers are going to be retail, logistics, and particularly transportation. So these sectors are areas where it's very easy to introduce automation. Retail, you think, for instance, of lots of McDonald's in London, for instance, have self-service checkouts now. Plenty of retail jobs could be automated in a similar way. You've got to go to Tesco's or something. You've got self-service checkouts there. Logistics, moving goods around the world. You already have ports, for instance, in the Netherlands, which are virtually fully automated. So these big shipping containers coming off of a ship, getting moved onto a truck, almost all of that is entirely automated nowadays. Same thing with transportation. So Uber wants to have a self-driving taxi service. It's already testing out self-driving cars in Pittsburgh. It tried doing it in California, but then got rejected. I think it's moved to Arizona now. But this is, you know, what is coming up is a lot of self-driving cars taking jobs from millions of people. The winners, though, or at least the sort of sectors where we can expect lots of job growth, happen to be healthcare. Now, healthcare has already been one of the biggest job growth sectors in the past 10, 20 years, but it's only going to get bigger and bigger. Now, this is for a couple of reasons. One is we have an aging population. So we have more and more elderly people to take care of, and we have less younger people to take care of them. So we see things like Japan using robots to take care of elderly people. But most healthcare is actually not very automatable. So this means that it still requires the human touch to do a lot of healthcare. This means that healthcare is going to be the big job-growing sector in the next 10 years, 20 years. If you look at the U.S. government's forecast for what is going to be the biggest job growth sector, it's healthcare by a long shot. So we don't have industrial economies anymore. Increasingly, we have care economies. Now, this is all in the strong labor power scenario. What happens if we have a weak labor power scenario? Well, in this case, we should expect slow wage growth. We don't have unions pushing for higher wages. We don't have workers mobilizing to get better conditions. This means that businesses have less and less incentive to invest in automation. So rather than buying, you know, this expensive machine, they can just hire five cheap workers to do the same job. So what should we expect in this sort of situation? We should expect high employment and low productivity. And it turns out the one thing that's worse than having robots take all your jobs is something like the UK economy. If we look at the UK, what do we see? We see slow wage growth. This here is an index of how much people are earning per week. We can see that it took a hit during the crisis, and it hasn't gone back to that level since. So we have very slow wage growth in the UK. We have high employment, though. More people are working in the UK than ever before on record. So this is a suggestion that actually workers are so cheap that businesses find it very easy to just hire up all these cheap workers. What do we see then? We see low productivity. And remember, productivity is a sort of measure of how much automation is going on in the economy, and productivity has been slowing down for decades. So rather than businesses purchasing, you know, new machinery, they're buying cheap workers to do the same job. And the end result is increased precarity for workers, worse and worse working conditions for workers. This is one measure of precarity, the number of self-employed people within the economy, and it's gone up and up and up over the past 10 years. It's, I believe, quadrupled over the past couple of decades as well. A huge proportion of people now self-employed, which doesn't mean people doing, you know, rich entrepreneurial stuff. It tends to mean people making do with low income, long hours, sort of terrible jobs. So we have two scenarios here. One, robots take lots of jobs. Two, we end up in the sort of UK situation of stagnant wages and increased precarity for people. Neither are very appealing. So to sort of conclude, will robots take your job? It depends. It depends on the strength of labor, crucially, I think. I think robots are going to take jobs almost inevitably, but the speed and the pace at which it's going to occur depend upon the strength of labor, most importantly. I think, though, in either case, we need to prepare for a different world. We need to rethink the welfare state that was built for the mid-20th century. We need to think the welfare state for the 21st century to start to deal with these different realities. Thank you.
Thank you. Our final speaker is Dr. Helen Hester.
Hi. How nice to see you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you so much to Danielle and the team for inviting me and to the LSE for hosting this event. Okay, so Nick started with a question. He started with the question, will robots take your job? Well, that partly depends upon who you are, I think. The changes that automation will bring to the employment landscape depend not simply upon technical developments and these kind of technical transformations, but also upon a wide range of social factors. Crucially, this includes the forms of work to which one has cultural access, something that's shaped by the fusion of gender, race, class, ability, nationality, and numerous other variables that we might sometimes talk about in terms of identity. Within the next 5 years or so, we are unlikely to see the wholesale substitution of machines for human workers. But we may well see paid work redistributed as the character of available employment begins to change. So the World Economic Forum's 2016 study on the future of jobs predicts strong employment growth across the architecture and engineering and computer and mathematical job sectors, a moderate decline in manufacturing and production roles, and a significant decline in office and administrative roles. So something that was sort of missed out from Nick's analysis there. It also speculates that many traditional sales jobs, such as that of the cashier, are likely to go as a result of emerging technologies. So whilst we can expect a kind of big uptick in the need for highly skilled programmers and technicians, those responsible for creating and maintaining automated systems, these systems themselves may make other kinds of paying jobs less necessary. So as you may already have suspected, the redistribution of labour that this implies is likely to be highly gendered. Drawing upon survey data gathered from large global employers, the report notes that women make up low numbers in the fast-growing STEM sector, whilst, quote, female employment is concentrated in low-growth or declining job families such as sales and office and administration, indicating a possible reversal of some of the gains made in workplace gender parity over the past decade. So the study estimates that between now and 2020, male workers will face 3 jobs lost for every job gained, and women workers 5 jobs lost for every job gained, as a result of this kind of reorganisation of paid work. In other words, there aren't sufficient new jobs to replace the old ones, the ones that are going, and those that are arriving are both highly skilled and highly gendered. If labour market transformation towards new roles within computing, technology and engineering continues to outpace the rate at which women are currently taking up these roles, then this clearly has an effect upon whose job is kind of most at risk over the next 5 years or so. This is assuming, of course, that the current gender balance of specific job families stays the same, which may not necessarily be the case. And it also notably fails to take into account the variation within gendered categories, subsuming all difference beneath a single banner of gender. One cannot really talk about women's experience of work, I think, given the myriad ways in which intersecting forms of oppression such as race, class, cis-sexism and able-bodiedness have affected the scope of women's opportunities, and as well as their kind of ability to enter or to withdraw from the labour force. The point remains, however, that the predicted effects of the so-called fourth industrial revolution are unevenly distributed. As such, we should be aiming to integrate gender, class, and other forms of structural oppression more fully into our understanding of the potential effects of automation. So I want to finish by quickly addressing one of the gaps in the World Economic Forum's report. Given its attentiveness to certain issues of gender disparity, it has surprisingly little to say about care work, either in its sort of paid or its unpaid forms. And this is intriguing, given that other sources tend to see professionalised care work as a growth area capable of offsetting potential job losses resulting from automation, and particularly in light of impending demographic changes, as kind of Nick sketched out. Indeed, some perceive a potential polarisation emerging between high-tech and high-touch jobs. So the management of technologies on the one hand and the care of bodies on the other. So Paul Preciado might refer to this as a distinction between immaterial and uber-material labour. Partly this relative silence is a result of the kind of employers with which the study engaged, So it was talking a lot to large global multinationals in 9 specific industry sectors. It also depends on the kind of work that the study considered. So it was focused on wage employment jobs in the formal economy. It's also likely to stem from the fact that comparatively few public sector employers, such as local government departments, participated in the research. And the World Economic Forum does touch on some kinds of reproductive labour in other of its publications, in other parts of its website and so on. However, the relative absence of care still registers as quite conspicuous in a study seeking to address something as encompassing as the future of jobs. After all, as the American economist Nancy Fulbright recognised in 2001, employment in professional care services has increased steadily over time, accounting for 1/5 of the total paid labour force, about the same as employment in the combined sectors of the manufacturing, mechanical, and construction industries. The popular image of work still tends to fixate upon masculinized forms of wage labour, and we need to remind ourselves that schools, hospitals, and daycare facilities are as central to what constitutes work as the building site or the production line. Equally, it seems unhelpful to discuss the future of jobs without also thinking about the future of work more broadly. So I'm thinking particularly here about the burdens of unpaid activities associated with domestic maintenance, tending to the body, and so on, which are kind of inextricably tied to gendered cultures of work. And tellingly, the report does briefly gesture towards unpaid domestic labour, but does so only to suggest that, quote, household work that is still primarily the responsibility of women in most societies could be further automated, leaving women to put their skill sets to better use in the formal labour market. So such comments are problematic for many reasons, not least for the vision of fully automated, immiserating capitalism that they kind of put forward. With the stubborn continuation of the gendered division of labour, women remain responsible for the bulk of routine domestic chores and childcare, even as their hours in the waged workplace are coming increasingly in line with men's. As two-income families feel themselves to be ever more time poor, many of the most affluent seek to outsource reproductive labour to a hyper-exploited class of cleaners, nannies, and care workers, many of them immigrant women within global chains of care. It is clear then that the home and the household and many of the un- and underpaid activities associated with them demands to be included in any meaningful attempt to characterise contemporary labour. Work, even in the limited sense of formal waged jobs, can't really be understood without them. This is important not just in terms of appreciating the nuances of what technological change might mean for the labour market, but also in terms of articulating a proactive politics in the face of imminent disruptive changes, a politics that does not transform the perceived scarcity of wage labour into an uncritical demand for more work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Shall we start by taking a couple of questions now? Yeah? If you could wait until the mic reaches you before you start speaking, that would be great. So I can see there's a hand shot up towards the back there. Where was it? Gentleman in the red.
Thank you very much. Nick, it was a fantastic explanation. My question is, could you clarify or can you give us more information when you referred that high employment and low wages are going to decrease, make low and slow economic growth? So the more that you have cheap labor, probably immigrant labor, the slower that the economy it's going to be because there's going to be less automation and less robots and less innovation in that sense. Thank you very much.
Can we take one more question before? Yeah. Question there.
Hi there, Mateo from Women in College. Thank you so much to the panel for their talk. I think my question is directed to all of the panel, but perhaps in particular as well, at Dr. Woodcock. So you talked about why we need to have a rating system, for example, and I'd like if the panel perhaps could reflect on the prominence of a sharing economy when we do talk about the emergence of, well, about the evolution of labour. In particular, I think, on regards to that particular point, my counter-argument would be that if we are going to start sharing and having our assets proliferated across to other people, we do need to ensure that we have the trust, and the rating system is that kind of trust which is ensured as we share our own assets and private property. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, I'm happy to take those two now.
Yeah. So I'm not exactly sure which point you want me to elaborate on, but I'll try and elaborate on all of it. I guess one of the big questions sort of post-2008 crisis is this problem of productivity. So the problem of why aren't advanced economies producing goods more and more efficiently? So it's happening in Europe, it's happening in North America, but it's particularly happening in the UK. For some reason, it doesn't seem like businesses are investing in the right technology in order to make the economy more and more productive. So the idea that, you know, with a machine you'd be able to produce X amount of widgets with one person, you can produce more once you start adding more and more machines. So this is the sort of question that economists are dealing with. Why low productivity? I think one of the key reasons why has to do with low wages. I think, and this is a sort of classic thesis from the 1950s and 60s, but workers are one of the spurs for businesses to invest more into technology. This is in part because, you know, as wages go up, suddenly machines are cheaper. It's also a way to control workers. So if workers are, you know, too strong, if they're making too many demands on business, if they're cutting into the profits of business, then one way to get rid of them is to automate them. And this has led to increased productivity in the past. You know, this sort of big burst of productivity in America was between 1920 and 1970. I think it's not coincidental. That's also the period when unions were at their strongest in America, when the labor movement was at its strongest in America. So I think this question of why aren't economies more and more productive today has to do with the fact that labor has been demolished since the 1970s, since the neoliberal period. And we're sort of seeing the outcome of that now. The fact that economies are just growing quite slowly, whether it be secular stagnation or just sort of tepid growth in general.
Yeah, so I want to respond to the question on the sharing economy. I think the idea of the sharing economy is a great one. You know, we have all manner of things lying idle that other people could be using, and I think it's really important that we think about new ways to cooperate and collaborate. Uber and Deliveroo, I wouldn't say, are part of the sharing economy. When we look at a platform like this, what it is essentially is an attempt to replace previous forms of, say, in Deliveroo's case, food delivery, with a platform that connects what are supposedly self-employed independent contractors with customers. And I think we have to be quite clear that this categorization is a bogus one. Deliveroo is a food delivery company that in the UK now employs 10,000 people, doesn't give them sick pay, holiday pay, all the employment rights that come with being an employee or a worker. And the technology is being used to find ways to increase efficiency and to control people. So the example I give with the rating system, absolutely, if you're going to lend things to people, you should have some form of trust. We would hope perhaps we could have trust without five-star ratings, but you know, perhaps that's a longer question. For Uber, for example, you can rate out of 5 stars, but if a driver's rating falls below 4.5, they're called in for a disciplinary meeting. And I find that astonishing. You know, what's the difference between a 4-star and a 5-star journey? You know, these ideas of what we expect out of the encounter is a very interesting one. And rather than encouraging an interaction that's positive and that we enjoy, what it does is put immense pressure on people. So, you know, you get in an Uber and you're offered a bottle of water or, you know, you're offered to charge your phone. Any conversation topic you have, suddenly the driver is interested in it and wants to talk to you about it. It's no longer a human interaction. It's one that's pressured by how the system has been designed. And the development of technology means that in reality, it would be very easy to design a kind of cooperative platform that could actually bring you together with drivers so that you could access rides from people that have cars. That's not what platforms like Uber and Deliveroo are aiming to do. They're aiming to make large amounts of profit off the back of falsely categorizing people not as workers. And so the reality of this kind of new world of work is hyper-exploitation, attempted to be masked over a digital platform with very glossy advertising.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction between kind of Uberization and the sharing economy. I mean, the sharing economy itself is, of course, a fairly marginal part of the economy as a whole. I'm always a bit sceptical about kind of claims that it's going to be the future, that it's going to be lead us on a trajectory towards post-work, for example. But I also think it's really interesting the way that your comments intersect with this whole idea of emotional labour that you deal with in your own work. So we wouldn't think necessarily of jobs in transportation, taxi driving, as being a form of emotional labour. Yeah. But increasingly, with this way of rating people, it has become that. You know, and you know, you're very aware of the fact that that this is a sort of a part of their job is to engage with you emotionally, to be an appealing human being, which is kind of quite extraordinary.
Absolutely.
I think this is always my problem. When you talk to proponents of Uber, oftentimes they'll say, well, yeah, but I talked to my Uber driver and they said they really enjoy it. Of course they're going to say that.
Yeah.
This is, yeah, they can't perform any negativity. They have to be constantly positive and, you know, this is absolute nonsense.
Yeah, but it's this idea that what you're getting in that taxi situation is like an authentic, you know, they are clearly performing their emotional labour incredibly well. Mm-hmm. If you're not recognising it as a form of labour, you think what you're encountering is a genuine interaction, but it is, you know, you can't say, I hate my job, I wish I was somewhere else, you know, you're not a nice person, you're stinking up my cab. Like, that's definitely going to get you beneath 4.5 stars, right?
I don't want to be locked into a credit arrangement on my Prius that means I now have to work for Uber. Yeah, absolutely.
In this distinction you just drew, Helen, between Uberization and the sharing economy, can you perhaps give us some examples of the sharing economy which don't fall into this idea of Uberization, and how did they succeed not to be recuperated in that way?
Well, I mean, Airbnb is a different kind of example, but that's not to say that because it's part of the sharing economy, it's not problematic.
Yeah.
Because obviously the way that, you know, cities like Berlin have experienced the effect of Airbnb has been really intense in the way that it's messing with rent and that whole thing. So I think, and it was, to be fair, Jamie's distinction between that, I just was like, yes, I agree, Uberization and the sharing economy are different things.
Should we take some more questions?
Perfect.
Gentleman towards the back there in the grey.
Hi, I'm Ollie Norman from the LSE in the geography department. And it's very interesting to hear your perspective talking about work, but I do think we need to kind of think about work in this sort of maybe dualism with leisure, because this is something that especially the sharing economy really sort of brings up. And especially with the use of kind of algorithms in the way that, especially in the context of delivery, people have to kind of work out what the constraints and the control that they're experiencing is. So you see a lot of delivery drivers sort of, they can do other things while they're not technically working. And does this kind of mean that we have to rethink how this kind of distinction between leisure and work?
Okay, and another one, gentlemen towards the front.
Hi, I think the talk's been amazing. There's been a lot of interesting points brought up. I have to say I'm coming from a slightly biased background. I'm a digital marketer who's transitioned to earning money from websites, so I don't really work any. Well, I can go several months without working. So I think the digital thing is amazing, but I'm curious to what the panel might think of what the outcome of all of this is going to be, because for me, I'm really interested in the Uber experience, because looking at the tech community and stuff, I keep hearing, oh, Facebook's amazing, Uber's amazing, and these companies are raising incredible amounts of money, and then they're channeling and funneling incredible amounts of money through those companies, but it's a very small amount of people who become incredibly wealthy. But the people that are losing their jobs aren't acquiring assets at the rate at which they're losing their jobs. So it seems to me, as an outsider looking in, never read any of these studies or anything like this, that we're going to have a situation where we're educating vast amounts of people to do somewhat labor-intensive jobs or information kind of pushing pieces of paper around or entering information into spreadsheets, which we know for a fact that computers have been invented to deal with. And so we're encouraging people to go and study those things, and we're saying that the jobs are going to disappear in large numbers. We're not encouraging people to acquire assets, which we're saying that the people that are doing well in these kinds of economies are the people that own the machines, the people that own shares and things like that in these companies, the people that know how to raise money and therefore float their company. But that's a very small number of people. It's like literally, I could probably name the 10 universities that you come out with if you can raise over 10 million. If you can't, you just can't compete marketing-wise, which people are soon going to start to see. And it seems like if you do own some assets, be it the over... Some people might say that... My question is going to end soon, guys. if you do own assets, it's property or equity. Equities is a bad investment right now because the market's funded by cheap credit. Equally, so is property. So,
can you frame it as a question?
Yes, I was going to say, what happens as all of this comes together? Like, it would be interesting to hear what people think, as, you know, people that do have assets are hurt and people that don't are educated to do jobs that don't exist anymore.
Okay, thanks. So two questions, one about the distinction between work and leisure, and then one about what's coming next, what's going to be the outcome of all of this.
Should we just tackle them one by one instead of, because I could go one and then the other, but it probably makes sense. You want to do work and leisure first?
I was going to do the second one.
Okay, well, I think they were both great questions and things that I really want to talk about a lot more. So on the work and leisure thing, yeah, it's of course, these things are increasingly bleeding together. And some people see this as being a great thing. So I'm thinking about Antonio Negri's idea of the cyborg worker as being, you know, you're doing this more immaterial labour and that's phenomenal. And, you know, you've got more agency and it doesn't even feel like work anymore, you know, which is a vision that I think the reality doesn't really bear out. You know, because the experience is not only that you are playing Candy Crush surreptitiously for 2 hours a day at work, but also that you are checking your work emails at 3 a.m. in the morning when you wake up. You know, so there is this bleeding together of work and leisure, which is going to be really important to try and navigate in any attempt to frame a post-work politics. So I think very rarely is that bleeding together discussed. But we also need to problematize the idea that there's a strict kind of distinction between those two things, right? Because for people with caring responsibilities, very often leisure is simultaneously work. So your leisure time is taking your kids to the swimming pool, which is, you know, not my idea of megalols. It's work as well as supposedly being leisure. So we need to make sure that we're aware of this fact that there has never really been a pure leisure. And that's something that we need to factor into what we're talking about in terms of imagining a proactive politics in response to perceived crises of work, I think.
Sure. So I'll try and pick up on this sort of, I guess, monopolization argument, which I think is really important for understanding the digital economy today. I'm sure probably a number of you saw the report that came out this week or last week, 8 people owning as much as the bottom 50% of the world. Now, this is based upon wealth, not income. There's issues with measuring the inequality in terms of wealth. But still, this is an incredible amount of inequality that 8 people can own as much as 50% of the world. And one of those people was the owner of Amazon. I don't think coincidentally. I think a lot of the sort of digital economy stuff has this sort of centralizing tendency to it, this monopolizing tendency to it, where the fact that as you gain more data, you can then use that data to improve your service, and then that gets more people onto your service, you get more data, and it's a sort of virtuous cycle. So Google and Facebook are the exemplars of this. I'm sure probably half of you hate Facebook. I hate Facebook. But we're all on it because it's just the social network site that everybody else is on. It has this network effect to it that we're all attracted to it. Now, this means that Google and Facebook dominate online advertising. I forget the exact figures, but it's an incredible amount of the online advertising just goes through Google and through Facebook. So this is something where it's a monopoly tendency, and the people profiting off of it are not average workers. They're the owners of Facebook, the owners of Google, the owners of Uber. And I think this is a real challenge that we have to face up to. I think it's one added sort of difficulty is just the fact that these things are increasingly sort of basic infrastructure of our society. So the ways in which we interact with people are through Facebook. The ways in which we get information is through Google. These are, in a certain way, they're very public infrastructures, but they're owned by private individuals and increasingly centralized. And I think this is a real challenge that we have to face up to in the next 10, 15 years.
So I want to say a little bit about both. I think, firstly, the question about play and work. I've been doing quite a lot of interviews with delivery drivers and cyclists. And one of the things they say is in the marketing, there's this kind of idea that they have the like ideal type of somebody who works in these kind of Uber-like companies. It's like usually young, probably male, you know, has a bit of spare time in between doing something else creative where they go and work for delivery or so on. The reality is, when you wait between jobs, there's nothing else you can do in that time. The next job could be 30 seconds away or it could be 45 minutes. And one of the big things that they want to do now is move from an hourly wage rate plus a drop, you know, a pound per drop, to entirely paying people on the drop rate. Now, what this means is in a company like Deliveroo, they want to shift all of the risk onto the people who, well, I would call them workers, but they're technically self-employed at the moment. And so what you will end up having is seeing people wearing Deliveroo uniforms and so on, standing around waiting for work, not being paid. You know, if there's no demand that day, they're not getting paid. And in a sense, we can see this as being, in some ways, like a return to older forms of work, you know, waiting around by the dock, seeing if you're going to be picked to move things, but in a new, being organized in a new way, not even being able to see your boss. You know, you never have contact with the physical Deliveroo. You just have an app, and it will tell you when you have work. And, sorry, did you want to...
Just on that point, I was a delivery driver for about 6 months, and yeah. I did a research project on that.
Fantastic.
Interesting to know how performative the control was, because if you really are struggling for money, and you're struggling, and you really want to do the job, then you're not going to stretch the limits, and you're not going to find that play within yeah. the structure. Whereas if you don't have that, then... obviously, you can.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's fascinating about some of these things is that you're not told, as I'm sure you know, whether what your time is in relation to the target. You're just told whether or not you're meeting it. You know, are you below it or above it? So you're never told what the target is, which gives you a sense that you always need to be working harder. You don't know whether you're comfortably in the targets. And so what I want to say briefly is something about gamification, which I'm doing a bit of research on at the moment, which I think we have to be very, very clear that applying ideas about play and game to work is something we should all oppose. It's a kind of techno-fascism. You know, work shouldn't have these, you know, scores and so on added into them. And in call centres, this is huge, giving you targets, forcing you to work to it. And the problem with it is... As people, we love a sense of play. You know, we enjoy games and we enjoy these aspects. And this is being mobilized against us to make us work harder and harder and harder and chase other people's targets. And it's a sign of the bleeding of work and play into one another. But we have to say, you know, we'll gamify things on our terms. We'll find out how to play the system. We'll mess around in a call center, but we won't let you force us into these horrible targets.
Do you want to respond to the other question?
I just had... thank you for your question, which I thought was really interesting and touched on kind of quite a lot of things that I think are really relevant to this discussion. And I was thinking as you were talking about this idea of the hourglass economy. So this idea that there's a kind of hollowing out of middle wage jobs. So you only have higher paid jobs or very low paid jobs. And also there's this kind of polarization in terms of hours. So people who are having to work very, very long hours, having more hours than they need or want, versus those people who are underemployed, scrabbling around, trying to find hours, trying to piece their kind of living together. And, you know, this is this hourglass shape. And then I was also thinking about the way, because one of my interests is in post-work politics and the way that the whole discourse around that is evolving. So kind of a political position that's seeking to move away from the work ethic. So instead of promoting work and seeking work and saying, well, we need more work for everybody, that's the dream. Thinking about how you might undermine that and start moving away from work as being the one thing that we find most meaningful. And one of the kind of formative post-work thinkers is André Gorz. And he was originally thinking in terms of the way automation might facilitate a kind of proletarianisation, which would mean that work could be distributed a lot more widely. So the fact that you don't need a specialist skill set to engage in certain kinds of production means that labour becomes more interchangeable. Anybody can do it. And for him, the big uptick of that, the big plus side, was that it was more, you were more able to distribute labour, socially necessary labour, fairly across a swathe of the population. So instead of having it bunched, you could distribute it. And in distributing it across a wider number of people, you would free up more time for individuals so that work took on a sort of decreasing, well, wage labour at least, took on a decreasing share of your kind of cognitive bandwidth. You know, and I think that that's an interesting thing to factor into discussions about work time and about hours and about the kinds of jobs that we have if we are seeking to advance, you know, a robust post-work position.
Should we take some more questions?
Please, yeah.
There's lots.
Yep.
Thank you all for coming. My question's tied to the growth of healthcare jobs and also gendered occupational segregation. So with this potential growth in healthcare, but then on the other hand, the so-called pink-collar economy of many women occupying nursing and home healthcare aid jobs, what is the potential for sort of closing gender pay gaps while you have this growth of the healthcare industry, but how could that potentially affect wages for predominantly female-dominated fields?
Thanks.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm Judy Wiseman. I'm here at the LSE, and it's a great panel. I just wanted to sort of pick up on a couple of things and wondered if you'd elaborate them. They're two completely separate things. I mean, one thing is, which I think you were sort of about to touch on, was the whole debate about a universal basic income, which I'm very nervous about, and I'm nervous about it because I'm worried that a sort of feminist critique isn't always in play in those discussions, and certainly when I have those discussions, it isn't in play. And I'm reminded of why I opposed wages for housework and what would and how could I be sure that a universal basic income wouldn't embed gender divisions rather than overcome them. So I'd love your, so given that you're going to your post-work, I'd love your comments on whether my nervousness is correct or not. But the other thing I very much was intrigued by was Jamie's comment about why do these platforms have to be privately owned? And ownership is something that's gone through a lot of what's said. And, you know, there was a sort of point, I think a year or two ago, I know Morozov, Evgeny Morozov wrote a piece, I think in New Left Review, talking about having a campaign to take back our data. You know, why didn't we own the products of our labour on Facebook, on all of these, you know, why is digital labour, free labour, given away? How could we have a politics where we own and we make demands to own this labour and these platforms? And I just wondered if any of you had some sort of comments in that direction.
Thanks. Okay, so two sort of three questions, I think. The first one about healthcare jobs and gender. The second one about universal basic income, particularly in relation to feminist issues. And then why these platforms privately owned.
Okay. So I'll start with the first one, the sort of rise of the care economy and particularly healthcare. And how does that sort of affect, I think, the gender division of labor and the gender pay gap and everything? I don't think any of it will naturally help any of that. I think it requires making that explicit that we are trying to overcome the gender division of labor and the gendered pay gap and everything. I think much more likely to happen is that more and more men might move into the healthcare sector and the care economy more broadly, but they'll also go with the low wages that tend to be predominant in that economy. I think that's the most likely scenario, and I think that we have to struggle against that. I don't think there's any sort of necessary outcome involved in that.
Yeah, no, I think there is another way that it could go as well, because talking about the kind of the fact that there are lots of traditionally feminized forms of labour which are being eradicated or that are imagined to be eradicated through automation. And at the same time, there is this rise and this sort of blossoming of healthcare jobs. the risk is that a lot of female workers who are displaced from office and administration and retail will move towards these healthcare jobs. So it will continue to be a highly feminised sphere, which will continue to suppress wages. So that's a kind of an anxiety as well, that it will just be this kind of ghettoisation of women in healthcare jobs. And, of course, a historical association with femininity is also sufficient to sort of suppress wages. So, you know, within, you know, cooking, cleaning and caring, these are traditionally the lowest pays kind of spheres. So I think that's something you need to factor into it as well. And sort of then there's maybe a little point of transition from that to this idea of wages for housework. So talking about gender and caring labour. So I have a lot of love for wages for housework. I really do. I mean, but not because of what the name suggests, which is this exchange of money for housework. I think I can see why that's interesting, but it's more as a lever than as an end point. And the activists behind wages for housework were always really clear about this, that that it was part, the way, the actual getting the money for the housework was one part of a wider struggle against work. So for me, wages for housework, rather than enshrining the value of work and of the work ethic, is actually part of a post-work challenge to it. So on the one hand, they were talking about how offering a wage for this work would be one tool to help regender it, to help facilitate the redistribution of this labour. And on the other hand, they said that what was crucial is demanding a wage for housework was part of denaturalising that labour. So instead of viewing housework as some kind of expression of the feminine personality, you know, oh, well, you know, women are always house proud, they love to, you know, do a little dust, you know, it sort of starts to challenge that idea, because in asking for wages for something, you then have greater ability to start refusing that work. It's recognised as work that can be struggled against, rather than as this kind of naturalised expression of a gender identity. And then the UBI, I completely agree with you that accounts of the UBI that don't integrate feminist critiques and responses are thoroughly inadequate. But the UBI is such a multifaceted thing. The fact that it's got support from both the right and the left shows that any attempt to think about a universal basic income must be accompanied by sustained political struggle. It can't be seen as kind of a fix to the issue of diminishing work cultures. But I'm also really sceptical of some things that I've read which say, okay, well, you know, we can't have a universal basic income because that sort of that would discourage bad behaviour in people. It would make people lazy. What we should do is we should move towards a caring economy where you get money for doing these kind of caring tasks. That some of the ways in which that is framed ignores the fact that the best bit of the UBI is the U. The fact that it actually provides a tool for moving away from these discourses of distinction that circulate around welfare, you know, good people versus bad people. The idea that some people who are impoverished are that way because of their own actions and their own personalities. And I think that this, again, is part of this denaturalising, something we need to kind of quite aggressively challenge in the work that we're doing around the end of work.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things that I want to say about universal basic income. The first is, I think it's absolutely correct to have concerns around it, and I think it needs to be contested, otherwise if it is to be implemented, something horrible will come out the other end. And I think it's worth thinking of UBI, universal basic income, a bit like wages for housework, in the sense of, just to extend a little bit on what you were saying, as, and this is couched in slightly old-fashioned terms, but as a transitional demand, as something that gets us closer to a nicer future. You know, it may not be that just receiving that demand would change everything, but it upsets our thinking about work, about the wage being tied to work, about the work ethic and so on. And so I think it's important that we engage critically with it and start pushing arguments around it. Now, what I want to say a little bit about is ownership, because I think it's easy to look at a platform like Uber and say, if we just removed the people who owned Uber, we would have an alternative that would be there. It's a bit like Facebook or Google. If you say, you know, if that was just brought under public or worker ownership, everything would be fine. the bits that we want to use from these platforms are a comparatively tiny part. Most of Facebook isn't what we want. It's complicated ways of collecting your data, both on and off Facebook, and building deep profiles that can be used to sell you things, and in the future will be used for quite terrifying things like whether or not you can rent an apartment, whether or not you can get a mortgage, whether you can get a credit card, and we'll start to see kind of horrible differentiation based on what your profile says about you online, which you'll have no control over, not to sound too dystopian. But the actual bit that lets us connect with people and share things is a fairly minor part of that. And there's some quite exciting examples of platform cooperatives being established at the moment. There's a few in the US, and there's some people at the New School in New York who've been writing about this. And I think there's a twofold thing that we need to argue for. That the technology is there to build these cooperatives. You know, it's much easier to do these things now, and we should be trying to do them. But what we need to recognize is what Uber is about competing with other companies, essentially. It's about capturing regulation, saying that they can have the self-employed status, and about extracting huge profits from what they see as a kind of automated future of transport. So we need to support and encourage people who are fighting back against these platforms. So the delivery workers who are organising with the IWGB in London at the moment is a fantastic campaign people might have heard about, but also finding ways that we can support alternatives to these things. You know, delivery take a third of the price of a meal that's delivered, a huge amount, and the driver gets a pound in the delivery fee. So we can talk about, imagine what you could do, you know, with that, you know, how much more people could be paid for doing a job like that. You could think of very different alternatives. But we have to contest those alternatives.
So I'll maybe just add a bit on the UBI stuff. I'm a proponent of UBI, but I think there are significant risks to it. And I think the sort of worry that people have is that if you could imagine a UBI being implemented today, most likely it would mean taking away a good chunk of the welfare state as well. And this is a sort of Milton Friedman-esque idea. Milton Friedman loved basic income. He thought basically give everybody a lump sum of money and get rid of public health care, child care, education, turn it all into a market. This is the neoliberal dream. And I think we do have to be very wary of some of the people who are supporting UBI today for the reasons why they want to support it. That being said, I think it's important to push for a couple of reasons. One is just to have a leftist voice in the debate, to not let the right dominate the conversation about what a UBI looks like. The other aspect is sort of what Jamie was suggesting. Just making the demand for a basic income raises really interesting questions. I've had conversations with my family that I've never had about work before just because they're interested in the idea of a basic income. And I think this is a really important part of it, is the fact that just by calling for it, people start to question, what is work for? Why am I working so much? What else could I be doing? I think that's really important. I do think we could also design a UBI that was actually fit broadly leftist principles. I think the challenge right now is that we don't have the social movement or the power to be able to actually implement it. So it has to be a long-term project. It's not going to be something that occurs anytime soon. And just finally on this question of the private ownership of data, which Morozova's put it forward, Jared Lanier's put forward a similar sort of idea, and I've seen some other people, very smart people, put forth the idea. The idea being basically that, you know, technically give people full control over all of their private data, their individual data, and then give them control over whether or not they give Facebook access to it or an advertiser access to it or anything like that. My concern is that this seems ripe for marketization of every piece of data. Suddenly, an advertising company will pay you for every piece of data that you give them. Facebook will pay you for every piece of data that you give them as well. And basically every aspect of your life becomes potential data to be sold off to somebody else. So I think this is the real concern for me, is that it could lead to massive marketization of our everyday lives. So I'm somewhat wary of it on those terms.
Just a very small bit to add to that. The problem with that will be that in order to access all kinds of services, there will be a pressure on you to do that. So you will be, in kind of Marx's ironic sense, doubly free. You know, you will have to give up your data to access things. You can choose not to, but you won't have any credit, for example. So it's a kind of a false promise in a way, I think.
This reminds me of the wonderful emails you get if you leave Facebook and suddenly they send you emails saying, oh, this person's missing you, this person's missing you. Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think, just to return quickly to the UBI thing, it's important to recognise that that is not the only kind of a strategy for post-work politics. It's not entirely based upon the idea of a universal basic income. Because, you know, it's also... it's important to see post-work struggles as being part of a historical struggle towards shorter working week. You know, So I think that's really important to have that in there, to understand that it is about a shorter working week, and to think about that in terms of... I saw recently, you know, the classic 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. I saw a new version of that that had 4 hours for work, 4 hours for rest, 4 hours for what we will, and 4 hours to catch them all. The Pokemon reference. And which sounds ideal. I'd like to spend an extra 4 hours a day on video games. That would be perfect for me. But I think that one thing to recognise, and this is quite interesting, there's been a very recent study, which I think is still embargoed, so I won't talk about it in too much detail, which looked at the redistributive effects of the UBI versus the redistributive effects of a shorter working week. So the model that they were using of the UBI was one that was fairly modest and implementable, so it wouldn't completely have replaced the wage. But still, the UBI was shown to have greater redistributive effects than a shorter working week, which I thought was very interesting and was not really something that I had expected, because I've always been a little bit on the fence about UBI. So I think maybe, obviously, this is going to be a very ongoing discussion. So many forums I've sat in where we're trying to talk about something else eventually come to the UBI. For some reason, right now, that's like... it's really in people's minds, and people want to talk about it and digest it. And exactly, the left needs to have skin in the game in order for us to kind of not cede this entirely and see a kind of a dismantling of the welfare state.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left, so I think we'll try and squeeze in three more questions we'll take in one go. So one here.
Hi there, thanks for a really interesting talk. I just want to ask you a sort of slightly science fiction question about sort of artificial intelligence and how far it might go in terms of, are there any sort of theories of how it becomes a sort of benevolent force where we can basically take out the private owners because we can trust the machine to regulate us as humans, because we're not very good at being humans on the whole at the moment, it seemed like that. That's it.
And there's another question here.
So for Dr. Hester first, I was wondering, what did you mean when you said, you talked about cultural access, that your job might or may not be replaced by a robot depending on the cultural access that you have? I don't know if that's a term in this field. And then for the panel, I'm wondering, do you, any of you, foresee a comeback of the social sciences? And the reasoning behind it is, obviously, this can't be automated, like, say, other jobs like data science and that sort of thing. So I'm wondering, will we see a change in the whole kick on data science that we're seeing now and see it revert to more qualitative sciences?
Thanks. And one more. Yep, gentleman towards the back.
Hey. Thanks for the lecture. But just in terms of the automation of work and how that correlates with wages, in a sense, I'm not too sure what the theory of strong labor actually holds on automating going on. Because, China's not exactly the best example of strong labor environments. And conversely, the healthcare aspect of it. I don't see, or it's not in anyone's forecast, nurses getting super well paid in any time soon. And conversely, aspects of the economy like stock trading are vastly automated. The vast majority of trading is done by algorithms, and you don't see any bankers going out of business because of that. So I wonder... What you make of these counterexamples?
Thanks. Okay, so there are three questions, one about AI as a kind of benevolent, potentially benevolent force, one about the role of the social sciences, and then the final one about relationship between automation and widgets.
Okay, I'll start again. Yeah, sure. So the AI question. In a sort of sci-fi sense, the concern is always, you know, AI taking over, sort of Terminator style, that sort of thing. When you read in the media predictions about that happening, they're always from people who aren't AI experts. So it'd be Elon Musk or it'd be Stephen Hawking, you know, smart people in their own right, but not AI experts. When you go and talk to AI experts, they're not worried at all. AI as we have it nowadays, which seems to do really magical things, is only good at one single task. And as soon as you try to train it to do something else, it forgets everything that it was doing on that old task. AI is pretty stupid right now. I don't think we have to worry about it. And the other point I like to always add is that basically, I don't think the Terminator-style thing is actually would ever happen if we got like this super intelligent, artificial intelligent being. I think it's more like her, where basically artificial intelligence emerges and just gets bored with humanity and screws off, you know? Goes and does its own thing. That's what I think would happen with like a super intelligent AI. I'll maybe touch upon the other point about China and the sort of automation sectors. So China officially doesn't have a very strong labor sector, labor movement. Unofficially, it has a very strong labor movement. All sorts of wildcat strikes going on, all sorts of informal unions. The amount of protests that go on around work there are immense. I think it is an extremely strong labor movement, actually, even if officially a lot of it's not allowed. And again, even if they didn't have a strong one, the wages are going up for whatever reason. And that's sort of the key mechanism that's initiating automation within China. On finance, you're absolutely right. So a lot of trading is now done by algorithms. I think it's something like over 50% of all trades on the New York Stock Exchange are done by algorithms nowadays. It's a huge amount. That's been pretty much fully automated. What isn't automated is the actual high-paying jobs in banking, which tend to be sales and service. So negotiating deals between different companies to, say, underwrite an IPO or something like that, that involves actually care labor. It involves a lot of emotional labor, going golfing with people, drinking with people to broker a $1 billion deal, that sort of thing. It hasn't been automated yet, and that's where a lot of finance jobs still exist.
Yeah, I'm going to have to be careful with the AI and machine learning question, because what I want to do is just go on a massive conversational rampage about gender and technology. I'm going to just do that in a very abbreviated form. I'll start by saying the World Economic Forum report says that risks to jobs from AI and machine learning are at present very, very low, or they're perceived to be very, very low, because as Nick says, you know, it's not really artificial intelligence. There's no general artificial intelligence yet. There's a bunch of kind of other stuff that I want to sort of bounce around. I'll just throw in here. One is in terms of interesting developments in machine learning and gender, the whole case of Tay, the Microsoft chatbot that was given the persona of a teenage girl, I think is absolutely fascinating. Both for the way there's this kind of this idea of the kind of the Turing test, what passes and what doesn't, as being a human versus being a computer. That's always had a gendered implication, because most people don't realise that the original version of the Turing test was based on trying to convince somebody what your gender was. So it's based on this parlour game where you had to pretend you were, where you had a man and a woman both pretending they were a woman, and you had to guess which one was a woman. So that I think is just really sort of tangentially interesting. And when you link that up with Tay, who I can't help but think they've given her this kind of teenage girl persona, because teenage girls are already not really seen as being fully human. They don't fully have a grasp on complex speech patterns, are always saying things that feel a bit glitchy, you don't really attribute full subjectivity to them. So there's all of that. And then I'm interested as well in this kind of the fetishization of AI to some extent. The fact that I've seen so many Twitter conversations going on about the ethics of instrumentalizing an artificial intelligence to do kind of human labor. And so much concern for these imagined future artificial intelligences, when there is complete blind spot about other kinds of non-human exploitation, particularly the way that we regularly abuse animals. Like, that's completely not ever part of the debate. So that all our only interest in kind of the ethics of engaging with the non-human seems to attach to AI. And what's fascinating is, with the Tay thing, there was this whole campaign about how it was ethically wrong of Microsoft to turn off Tay. Like, you know, it was wrong for them to do that because they were shutting down a human, they were shutting down a person, they were shutting down an intelligence. It was wrong. And that, compared to the way most women who try to articulate an opinion on Twitter get treated, is just, they're just worlds apart. And then also, when you mentioned Her, that was triggering off a load of stuff, because Her is a really interesting film in terms of the way it deals with the automation of care. Like, the whole Samantha, the app, is about the automation of care labour. So that's both organisational labour, it's this kind of, she's a sort of therapist, she's also a sex worker. You know, there's this phone sex scene, which is supposed to be a mutual relationship, but to me is quite obviously a form of work that's being performed by this kind of electronic assistant. So there's a whole load of stuff that's in there. And I just wish, you know, if we had a whole event on like gender and technology, I would go into all of this in lots of detail, but it's a brilliant question. But I'll have to leave it there. In terms of what I meant by cultural access to work, I was thinking about the kinds of work that feel most available to us. So the kind of work that we are, through various explicit, implicit, conscious and unconscious means, the work that we are channeled towards, the work that we feel we are entitled to or that we have an affinity with. One way to think about that is, again, in terms of gender and technology. So the fact that there are certain kinds of machines that are not associated with femininity, and other kinds of machines are. So the washing machine is one great example. You know, the fact that you can have teenage boys who can, you know, program an app and, you know, get their PlayStation to work across various platforms, but they can't seem to figure out how to turn on a washing machine. That's because they don't have cultural access to that technology. They're sort of, it's almost like, and that lack of cultural access means that they're actually freed from labour. So in that context, masculinity functions as a domestic labour-saving device. So that's what I was talking about. The fact that women, many women and gender non-conforming people sort of filtered towards certain kinds of work based on their identity, that form of cultural access. Does that make sense?
So I want to add a couple of things on the question of China and recommend the China Labour Bulletin, which is run by an exiled labour activist who now lives in Hong Kong, which tries to track industrial disputes in China. It's absolutely fascinating. There's a huge, as Nick has said, huge kind of labour power that's beginning to kind of awaken in China. And because it doesn't happen through the official trade union, which is tied to the Communist Party, it's often very explosive wildcat action. You know, you have huge strike waves, many of which are put down by the army and aren't reported on in the press and so on. I think because of that, it's difficult to kind of to trace what's happening. But to give you, I guess, two kind of signals of this. The first one is the fact the army is regularly used to put down strikes. The second one is there are now zombie factories in China. And now what this means is factories that have stopped working, but the local boss or state is so worried about sacking these people because of their industrial power that they're continuing to pay their wages even though they're not coming into work, which shows a sign of the potential power of a huge working class in China, which, you know, it's very worth keeping an eye on for some developments there. In terms of AI, I want to return to the theme that I started with, which is looking at the labour that goes into these things. So I do some work with some people who make artificial intelligence programs. They do computational creativity. I love reading the stories about AI and then asking my colleagues, you know, what do you think of this? And the big one at the moment is AlphaGo, so the ability of this computer program to play Go. It's taken a huge amount of work. It beat, you know, the world champion at Go and so on. And people are saying, you know, this represents a huge step forward in AI. Now, there are some other games you can apply artificial intelligence to. For example, if anybody knows what a game called StarCraft, it's a real-time strategy video games, massively more complicated than Go. You're not moving single pieces around. Artificial intelligence comes nowhere close to beating humans at it. So this idea that artificial intelligence is kind of reaching this peak moment is nonsense. You know, it can beat you at Go. I'm not too worried about Skynet beating me at Go. That's fine. It can go ahead. If it can start controlling, you know, huge amounts of things simultaneously and outcompeting people, that's when things become a lot more concerning. And I think when we talk about AI, I'd love the idea of a benevolent AI, you know, taking over. Unfortunately, technology comes out of the social relations from which it's developed. And so when we see examples like Tay, or we see examples of racial profiling coming out in facial recognition software, we build technology that comes from our social conditions and often represents the interests of people who've paid for it. So we develop these kind of partisan kinds of technology. And I think call centers are a fantastic example of this. You know, if the old demand for workers' control, taking over a factory, running it for your own means, producing new things, doesn't exist in call centers. What would you run a call center for if you could take control of it for workers? You know, would you bother people with something else? You know, all of the technology is designed to make you make as many calls as possible. There's maybe like one moment you could see kind of mobilizing a demonstration. If you could call 400 people a shift, that might be quite useful. But as a kind of long-term thing, the technology is so, capital is so deeply embedded in the technology that for most people in the call center, workers' control would represent turning the light switches off and leaving. And I think that's a really important thing to think of, is what things can we repurpose and what things need rethinking completely. And as I'm the last to speak here, I'm also going to shamelessly plug my new book on call centers. So if you want to know a little bit more about, you know, emotional labor and how these things work, I have some copies, so please do come up and see me at the end. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for coming and invite you to...